When we requested to use this laboratory building for some new experiments with lasers and amplifiers, I'm not sure the administration knew exactly what we were up to. I think this is the first time we're doing kind of dance party in an academic building. Please join me in welcoming Montmos.
Check, check. Thank you, Ken. Wow, it's very goth, the reverb behind my voice, so I think we're just going to have to imagine that. That the Hearst Mining Building is a kind of hall of the dwarves. So if you bring out your.
Bloody awful. Maybe we should just skip it.
Should we stand over there? All right, is that clearer? Is there less reverb?
No.
Okay. What I'm going to do is sort of test the reality of analog as a superior medium in the sense that there's this incredibly rich continuous spectrum of feedback as I move through the space. And what you'll notice is that the resonant overtones of my speech, you know, I'm essentially playing the room and I'm creating an aleatory encounter between my microphone and this speaker right now. When I'm moving closer, what you're hearing are a beautiful soup of ephemeral, fleeting frequencies that this audio system is making available. Do you think we should turn it off and just talk loudly?
It's fairly torturous, right? I
mean, yeah.
It's like all low, mid-range, and nothing else.
This is what happens if you invite sound nerds.
We were asked by Ken, do you have a title? And normally when you're a sound artist or an artist, you give an artist talk, which is a kind of trade show sort of promotional demonstration of your aesthetic disguised as free associative, and then I made this piece and then I made that piece. But the standards of this lecture series are far higher, and they want a title and they want an abstract, so I pounced on the title, The Re-Dematerialization of the Art Object. And it's timely to have a topic like this because of the Bruce Nauman show that's on campus at the Berkeley Art Museum. Can you raise your hand if you've seen that show? Did anybody go to it?
That's okay. All? It's on your own campus. That much.
Well, I thumbs up to the people who went, and to those who haven't yet, please, it's running until the middle of April, so it's definitely worth your while.
It has the same name of a recent album of ours.
Yeah, there's a kind of branding. See the
on
trade
Matador
show,
Records.
The trade
available
show.
Available at your local.
It's bound to come up. And we'll get a little, we'll return to that title, The Rose Has Teeth in the Mouth of a Beast. And its similarity to the Bruce Nauman show, A Rose Has No Teeth, in a little while.
I left yours on, right?
So, cashing out this title, The Re-Dematerialization of the Art Object, like a lot of people who work with samples or appropriation, this is essentially a rip-off move on our part. We are ripping off Lucy Lepard, an art historian who first used the phrase in an article in 1968 in Arts International that she co-wrote with John Chandler, in which this expression, the dematerialization of the art object, first appeared. And then she liked it so much that later on in 1972, when she collected this anthology called 6 Years in the Dematerialization of the Art Object, 1966 to 1972, did I do the math there? Yeah. She again chose to sort of hinge her argument on this term. And it's a term that kind of raises some immediate objections and possibly some fairly sophistical objections to what this term is trying to do. What she's hoping to do is rope in a set of practices in the art world that were emergent at that time and to coin a phrase that would bind them together thematically around the primary focus upon the idea. And because I don't want to get it wrong, I have these props that make you think that this was all written ahead of time. Conceptual art for me means work in which the idea is paramount and the material form is secondary, lightweight, ephemeral, cheap, unpretentious, and or dematerialized. So that was Lucy Lepard's first definition of what would count as a dematerialization of the art object in conceptual art strategies. Her second, and this is another, I think, important one, was that conceptual art offers a bridge from the visual to the verbal. So in the first case, it's the primacy of the idea and that execution is largely secondary. And this is something that we can see happening in manifestos from before this, such as Saul Lewitt's 1967 paragraphs on conceptual art, in which he said that the idea is essentially a machine that creates the work. So people start to make art which consists primarily and foundationally of a concept, and execution becomes secondary, ephemeral, cheap, unpretentious, and dematerialized. Now, of course, everyone can look at this kind of a statement and say, well, yeah, but there's still a material basis to it. There's still photographs on the wall of an action. There's still a sign or a manuscript or a physical space in which you pay to ride the bus to go to the gallery to see the artwork. And she had a snappy one-word response, which was, granted. It's kind of a good conceptual art, kind of less is more answer. Like, yeah, no shit, like, okay, yet, in terms of torquing the attention of the viewer beyond the material expression and towards the conceptual cause, I think her short answer that, yes, I know conceptual art still has some material basis, but nonetheless, it's directing us towards something else, successfully tips her hat that her real goal in, as an argument is not ontological but aesthetic. That is, the point is to reconceive what it is that the art object might be, how it might work, how it might resonate, how it might be transmitted, how it might not cost anything, how it might take on a kind of joke-like linguistic structure that's shareable, viral, portable, cheap, ephemeral, all of these qualities that for her are constitutive of this moment. Now, probably some of you are very familiar with this trajectory and are wondering, like, why are you summarizing this? And perhaps others of you maybe are less familiar or less warm and fuzzy about this era in art history, which to some people is a little bit puritanical and kind of anorexic in its relation to aesthetic pleasure. So to just kind of briefly give you some examples of what this sort of artwork is like, there's Ed Ruscha and Mason Williams's piece, Royal Road Test, in which driving at 90 miles an hour from LA to Las Vegas, they threw a typewriter out the window. That is the piece. Another example might be Robert Barry's Inert Gas series, in which he released various gases on the beach at Santa Monica. So one piece was to release 100 cubic feet of argon gas into the air, and that is the piece. Again, ephemeral. Pretty damn ephemeral. I think my favorite Robert Barry piece is the telepathy piece, in which the piece consists of him attempting through telepathy to transmit the art piece to its audience. So, all right, did you get it? All right. And since it's Berkeley, I think it'd be remiss not to mention Lee Lozano's Grass piece from 1968, which consists of a single instruction, stay high all day, every day. See what happens. So, nothing to buy, nothing to see, but plenty to think about. And it might strike you as snake oil or bullshit, but it might also strike you as a totally invigorating stance toward what art can be, what art could do in terms of gaining leverage on the institutional frameworks around objects that get sold and accrue cultural capital, how art might or might not be like a kind of chorus or a hook of a pop song that circulates through your head as you walk around and you have that art piece in your mind in the imminent moment in which the conceptual art piece is what you are thinking about. The infinite richness of that telepathy piece, precisely because it could be any pleasure-giving form whatsoever. And once you know about it, you already have the art piece in your possession. It's yours. So there's something at once alienating and exciting, I think, about this moment in art history, this moment of attempting to take, you know, 20 steps back from the game of creating objects and selling objects and to think outside of a material orientation.
Skip to the next part.
So we have one example. We wanted to make a song about the punk rock singer Darby Crash from the band The Germs. Does anybody listen to The Germs? Okay.
More people have seen the Bruce Nauman show.
All right. He's cool too. If you're a big fan of the Germs, you get this thing that's called a Germs burn. And it's a Germs burn is a cigarette burn in your inner left wrist. And it's only a real Germs burn if a member of the Germs gives it to you. Or if somebody who was burned by a member of the Germs gives it to you. So it's kind of like getting gonorrhea. Like you have to try to get as close as possible to the rock stars to get the real thing. And
they are the only people who have it.
Yeah, it's equal opportunity. So through some friends, we got to know the drummer, Don Bowles, from the Germs, and he agreed to burn my flesh with a cigarette. And we shot video and recorded the sound of that and built our song for Darby Crash that was, in essence, our portrait of Darby Crash entirely out of the sound of burning flesh and my cry of pain.
And the next part?
A new laptop that, like, heats up and goes black after 3 hours. And, you know, so there's a very much a material basis to the digital world, and I know this. Nonetheless, I think it's striking how much of Lucy Lepard's rhetoric applies to the circulation of culture now. If you spend an afternoon on YouTube, what could be more ephemeral, what could be cheaper, what could be more unpretentious than watching people do floor dancing, say? Have you ever typed in the phrase floor dancing on YouTube? Floor dancing is when you lay on the floor and play your favorite song and go like this. And if you think about it, it's not very different from a video of Bruce Nauman in the Berkeley Art Museum going, which is his thigh piece called Thighing. That is, I'm not making up the fact that there are certain echoes or resemblances or choruses that are getting repeated in terms of less interest in making an object or selling an object when you can quickly represent an action and make that action through the fact that now digital means have allowed video files to be small and ephemeral and portable in ways that before they were kind of onerous and bandwidth hogging. So the sort of circulation of culture, what people are enjoying. If you think also about the joke-like structure of conceptual art, that if I tell you about Robert Barry's piece, you kind of get it, and now you can tell someone else about it, and it just spreads and spreads. And then think about the pace of your media day, in which you get the same forwarded YouTube link from four different friends going, oh my God, have you seen the player piano that does Van Halen's Jump? You know, and you get it like boom, 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 that there's the same sense of like a viral transmission of portable, joke-like, easy, ephemeral, fun things. I don't think there's such a difference between a photo of somebody in the late 70s doing a really cool handstand getting presented as art and the chattering classes sitting around trading files of the world's best freehand circle drawer. So there's a similarity there at the level of what is the culture enjoying, how is it circulating its content, and where does that stand in relation to the idea that it was something that you paid for, it was something monumental, it was something laborious.
And skip to this part.
Wow, look, I'm stroking this metal rod and now you hear the sound. Do you get it? Get it? Do you see, you know, where
it works for me.
But that need for a gesture is part of the problem with electronic sound, that electronics divorced utterly the connection between gesture and output. So I hit my finger down on a sampler's keyboard and you hear a Smurf, or you hear a Hawaiian ukulele, or you hear a funky breakbeat from a James Brown record. You know, that there's that kind of, it could be anything, so in a way it's all kind of equally meaningless. That's the big risk of precisely the appetitive, I'll collage everything in sight school. And if you have no connection between a gesture, I mean, I don't know why it's inherently interesting to watch someone do this, but not inherently interesting to watch someone do this, but it's just true. So luckily, you know, we try to play the objects, though. When we played the cow uterus live, it didn't work so well. It had a hole in it.
It had a hole in it. When you order a cow uterus, you don't know how big it's going to be when it comes in the mail. And the first one we got was quite large.
And airtight.
And the second one we got was pretty small, but airtight. And the third one we got for the show had a hole in it that was stitched crudely up. Why, I'm not exactly sure.
And we were inflating it with a vacuum cleaner full of air and then squeezing it and playing the vaginal lips like a bagpipe.
Vaguely like
sort of like ish. Yeah.
There's a bag and it inflates and it gets squeezed.
But the one at the show wasn't airtight, so when Martin's like, aha, it just made
this. And then the whole conceptual thing fails because there I am doing this action and no one has any idea why, and there's no card.
And it doesn't sound good
to explain. And you know, I could stop and say, well, usually I'd be, but that's lame.
See, if you had a digital uterus.
And we will soon enough.
Yeah, I'm sure it's coming.